Blog Talk Radio.
This is Yasa Sago, a 7th grade grandson of Sawanuka, keeper of the Holy Cherokee Ark, who during the American Revolution became first beloved man of the Cherokee, head man of the Upper, Middle, and Lower Cherokee. Please join us at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday evening and learn how you, regardless of ancestry, may gain the privilege of worshiping as you please, even using indigenous, plant-based, native sacraments. Aho. You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Anahuakis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keeper's Prepper's Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. Osio Ginalii Tahiju Toigu, which means, hello cousins, I'm fine, how are you? This is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau in east central Tennessee, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the old Cherokee Nation.
Well, folks, welcome to this installment of Prophecy Keepers Radio. This is Bluewater, and our guest is Don Jaime Perez. He is author of Traditional Pathways, A Pilgrim's Journey, which is available for $9.99. I just want to say that Don Jaime contacted me, I guess, a little over a year ago and offered to send me the book, and naturally I was delighted, but I didn't get around to reading it for many, many, many months. And once I did, I realized that you know, from the time of year and things that were going on in my life right then, it was the right time for me to read it. And I guess that was shortly before the time the Prophecy Keepers radio was inaugurated. So without any further introduction, Don Jaime, welcome to the show.
Good day to you.
Well, I understand you've been in Mexico, and to introduce you a little bit further, I guess, you know, you're a man of letters. You're also a political candidate. Are you still a candidate for mayor in El Paso?
No, I get involved in politics every often, every so often, because I think it's important that the native voice be heard. Although I don't necessarily identify it as that, I think it's a much broader focus. But I think it's very important for people to be involved in the life of their community.
Well, who knows? Maybe we'll be calling you Alcalde someday. But anyway, you've done translation work, I guess, for Don Hunbach's men, and have associated with other elders. So let's just let you tell your story. I guess originally we were going to speak with you just before Cinco de Mayo, and technical problems ensued, and then we found out you were headed down to Mexico, so this was the right time for you to have your interview. So tell us what's been happening.
Well, I have just returned from Mexico City, where I met with a number of elders who are doing some excellent work in the states of Nayarit, which is a strongly Huicho area, in Oaxaca with the Mixtecos, and in Mexico City itself with the Nahua groups. And basically, it was a ceremony of consecration for what is described by them as kind of the new commitment or the new era that we're entering. I think the starting point of the discussion should really be that there are so many stories out there, so many voices out there that are trying to let people know that the wisdom of the ancients is a great deal more practical and a great deal more grounded than has been, I think, presented by Western perspectives. And oftentimes there's a frustration among the elders in the various native communities that their words, their stories, their narratives, their life experiences are presented almost in a caricature, in a cartoonish fashion, and to fit into some preconceived mold of whoever it is that's telling the story. And so one of the things that they have very keen on, or who have a very strong interest in doing, is to tell their stories, and for those stories to be understood on their own terms, not retranslated to fit whatever mold the storyteller might want it to fit. And so part of this movement, I would say, of elders is what I just came back from in Mexico City, and it was a very simple ceremony. It was basically a commitment by some of the elders of these various communities to simply say to the world that they want to be listened to on their own terms. Now, what that means is that oftentimes the stories of creation, the stories of relationship to Mother Earth, the stories of their pilgrimages, the stories of their development as communities over time, are stories that are very practical, grounded stories. Oftentimes, the way in which they tell the stories is through metaphor. And the metaphor then becomes the caricature by the time that it gets to the ears and eyes of the Western audience. That what they are seeing are caricatures. Oh, interestingly, I was listening to your previous interviewee, Mr. Mills, and he was describing some of the glyphs, some of the pictographs that are found in Giza and that are found in the Hopi and so on. Well, part of the work of Hunbach's men, which I respect a great deal, has been that kind of transcultural work. He did an analysis, a linguistic analysis of the Tibetan language, the Hopi language, and the Mayan language, and he found a very similar coincidence, if you will, of glyphs, of pictographs in the pyramids in the Mayan area, and He just eats and so on. And he finds that that same sort of coincidence. He also did a very interesting ethnographic study or research, and he found that there were artifacts of trade between the groups from as far north as the Vancouver area, where we know of obsidian and other instruments that were found, and all the way to Tierra del Fuego in Argentina and Chile. So the extent to which there was an exchange of ideas, of traditions, and of trade among the various ancient peoples was quite extensive, and the position, or I guess the viewpoint of Don Humbert's men, is that in fact that history has been erased from the Western consciousness, and part of his work is to bring that about. So I think that's by way of introduction what I have been working with over the last number of decades. My own work is in searching out or culling out the various ways in which Native people think about the universe, the way that they see truth and knowledge, and the way they see their own place in the world. And what I have done, my own transcultural work, has been to visit communities from as far as Vancouver and the northeast of the United States into various communities in the northern part of Mexico, and then on down south to Oaxaca and Chiapas and those areas, is to find the links and the similarities in the way people think of themselves. And in the book that you referenced, I was my first attempt at recording some of these similarities. And the basic position of these groups is that the origin of, or the first consciousness, if you will, arises from the Chichimecas. And the Chichimeca, basically what that means is earth people. The original consciousness, or the first organized consciousness of people in the Americas, is from the Chichimeca, which thought of themselves as basically arising from Mother Earth, and understanding and realizing that there is only one earth family. And if you look at today, the various ways which the academic world approaches the way to think about the world, they divide the world into races and ethnicities. And what I find most interesting is that the Chichimeca, way back when, were set forth this idea that there are no separations, that in fact we are one human family, and that if you take that as a point of departure, then you see that the kind of tribalist thinking which has been the curse of the modern era is basically an invention that comes along much later in this historical continuum. One of the, and I'm jumping at these historical eras tremendously, but I do want to get this out. So in the modern day, these groups that are still existing today, because you got to remember that in Mexico, you still have 30 million people that are still speaking the native languages, whether that's Maya, Huichol, Rarámuri, or Nahuatl. You still have people who are living still in the old cosmologies and with the old traditions. And one of their frustrations is that people want to categorize them in the way that I just did, as somehow separate from each other. But within their own elder communities, with their own elders' councils, they don't see that separation. They don't see themselves as different from each other. They see themselves as connected philosophically as one earth family. And part of the reason that this Hispanization of teaching all these communities Spanish, or in the case of the United States, teaching these communities English, these languages have really been transformed into very universal languages that have allowed these groups to, these various communities, I should say, alive and well in the United States. Samuel Huntington is no slouch. I mean, he's a very, very well-respected professor of history at Harvard University. And there are any number of people that subscribe to his point of view. His, one of his nemesis is a man by the name of Fukuyama, who has written The End of the World as We Know It. And basically his thesis is that we're headed toward a democracy, that the world itself is headed towards a democracy, because that has, is the end of history. I mean, that is kind of like the highest ideal of how people should relate to each other in the modern world, and he sees that he sees that going in the other direction to Huntington. The elders, in the meantime, are saying, okay, well, this is all very well and interesting, and you have these academics arguing with each other over whether, in fact, our destiny is democracy or whether our destiny is to be fighting each other because of our ethnic background or our culture, and they're kind of waiting for their opportunity to get into mix and say, you know what, we need to go back to the origins. We need to go back to how our own people saw the world, which was a world of one family with many offshoots appearing in various parts of the globe, with everyone having something to contribute, something unique, something marvelous, something fantastic to contribute. And that in respecting that diversity, but tying that diversity to the fact that we're only one family is something that needs to be said, and it's something that needs to be respected. It's something that needs to be put front and center in the consciousness of everyone, that whether you're native, non-native, African, Asian, and so on, that if we take that as a point of departure, it'll go a long way to creating the social structures that we need in order to create a more peaceful world.
Well, that goes along with what my teacher, John Red Hat, used to say. He said that diversity is the mark of the Creator. He says we are His garden, and all the different colors and shapes, and he says where there is diversity, he says the Creator is at work. Well, for the folks that want to follow along that are on the internet right now, Don Jaime's website is casajaguar.com, CASAJAGUAR.com. And our guest is a seventh level jaguar priest, correct?
Yes, in the Mexican tradition, you have what they call houses, and my own background is from the Huichol community in the state of Durango, which is the north central area of Mexico. And I was brought to the United States fairly young, consequently learning English. In that tradition, you have a strong tradition of houses, or what they call Caliways. Caliway is actually the root of the Caliway. It is Aztec, Cali meaning house, and Way meaning creator, the house of the creator. And the Caliways are the kind of cornerstones of the kind of religious tradition of the Huichol. And in the native communities in Mexico, and those are the ones that I'm most familiar with, I won't comment on others as much as those I know intimately, they are divided by houses, and each house will have kind of a division, excuse me, a division of labor. And those that follow the healing path are considered to be within the House of Jaguar, and that's the seventh order. And the healers are members of the seventh order, and the initiations that one experiences and one goes through are then consistent with that of the healer path. And so I consider myself a healer first and foremost, and an educator or a teacher second.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
It's the little yellow pill that scientists say could eliminate chronic diseases and help you live well into your hundreds.
You might be able to increase the lifespan of a mammal by 50%. And, of course, if that was a human being, then that might be in the order of 130 to 150 years.
That claim might be hard to swallow, but tonight on ABC's Primetime Live, co-anchor John Quiñones takes the promising antioxidant therapy called Protandim.
I have become a guinea pig for ABC News and primetime. It's not a drug. It's a supplement. It's called Protandim, and it's a combination of five exotic plants that have been around for centuries. Have you discovered the fountain of youth?
I wouldn't put it that way, but we may have discovered something that will tell us a lot more about how we age, what happens biochemically, and maybe how we can slow it down.
Quinones has been taking Protandim for 2 weeks now and tells Extra,
I am sleeping better, I feel a lot better, and also energized when I do wake up.
Primetime puts Protandim to the test tonight.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
Okay. Well, I'm aware of a prophecy that speaks about their return to the seat of the Jaguar. And I can understand now why there are parallel prophecies among Mormon people and other people that say that there will be a return to not only the there are prophecies of a physical return of people down to the area of Mexico for the purposes of learning or regrouping, and you might want to comment on that.
I think that there's certain things that need to kind of be laid out for those of you and those of the audience that may not be too familiar with the native tradition of Mexico. The first is that and there was a man who wrote a very interesting book on the geography of thought. The native tradition is very similar to the kind of Asian tradition in that time is considered circular. So when people say the return of the jaguar, it is in the consciousness of the native means that time is not linear. In other words, we do not move forward in time. In other words, you're in year 2000 and you think of year 3000. It is not a going to, as you would in the Western thinking, but rather a returning to that place of consciousness. And so that's very important to understand. So a lot of people say, well, you can't go back to the old days. And that's because in their thinking, they're thinking in a linear way. And they're saying, well, how can you go back to the year 1000? But if you see time as circular, in other words, that you are at once in all times, that time is simply a measure of movement, then you are always in all times. And so when you return to a consciousness, what you are saying is that you become fully conscious of that way of thinking, or of that time that you were referring to. So the return of the jaguar is at once a going back to the past, but it is also a reaching out to the future if you think of time as circular. So I think that's a very important point for people to understand in terms of the way that natives think versus what I call the Western kind of European way of thinking of time. The second thing is that movement is absolutely essential in the understanding of the world. In other words, interacting with the world is critical and essential in the way that people see their environment and interact with their environment. So the reason that I called my book Traditional Ceremonial Pathways A Pilgrim's Journey is because in each and every community that you go to that's a native community, you will have any number of rituals that imply movement, going up a mountain and fasting and vision quests and initiation ceremonies and gatherings and equinox and solstice ceremonies and so on and so on and so on, because it is in the interacting physically of your own body with your own mind, and then of the interaction of the mind-body with everything that's around you in a tangible physical way, is the only way that your knowledge is going to grow as a human being and as a member of your own community. And this do not live in their own mind, which is a little bit different than I think some other traditions that talk about meditation, that talk about going within, that focusing on a center point like yoga, Buddhism, and so on and so forth. That is understood in, I dare say, in the native tradition as a part of a process, but it is not complete until you come out of that internal space and interact with your environment. So consequently, what you find, and this is strange to many people in the Western tradition, is that they find all kinds of powwows and fiestas and pilgrimages and all kinds of activity constantly throughout the year. And in fact, Mexico, I think, has some to Europe that kind of a reputation. It's a never-ending party. And what they mean is there's always something happening, whether it's a coming of age or whether it's a naming ceremony or whether it's someone going off to find their connection with Mother Earth and so on and so forth. There's any number of physical activities that are codified, that are actually part of the life of the community. And the reason for that is because knowledge comes only through the interaction of mind-body with the environment. There is no separation.
So you can't go without until you go within.
And vice versa. It's only going without that you can know more of what's within. That's that interplay of the inner and the outer that has to happen in order for you to gain true knowledge in the way that the natives think about the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those are for people who are not really familiar with the native, the concept of time or the way that we see time and or understand time and the interaction of the inner and the outer. Those are the two very, very important elements if you want to understand what's going on in native communities. And the third, I think, element that's very important to understand is that the impact of the current technology, the fact that we're communicating through long distances and that you're communicating through a much broader audience, through the internet and so on, that's an amazing sort of thing. Knowledge was transmitted in the native communities from one person to another, through an elder, through an apprentice. That apprentice system is alive and well in native communities. And one of the things that is most interesting is that the impact of mass communication, internet specifically, technology, is really having an impact in native communities. And that's one of the adjustments that are having to be made, because whereas in the old day, the information was transmitted over a space of 10 to 50 to 20 years. So people would apprentice up to 20 years with an elder. Now, the information is so readily available that that is becoming shorter in the space of time. So now people can complete an apprenticeship program, for example, in 5 years or 6 years or 7 years. And so the elders are having to adjust to that because the communities are being impacted not only by the technology, but also by the market of ideas. There's so many ideas coming from so many places, and so many people have an opportunity of being creative and coming up with new ways of thinking of things. Our own science or knowledge base is growing so much and is so broad that Native communities are having to adjust to that. But in their mind, this is all good news, because what that means is that they now have the opportunity, someone who does not have a lot of resources, but who has a strong conviction of the heart of idea, can compete with those people who have a tremendous amount of resource, because what is of value is going to be whether the ideas are functional, whether the ideas are grounded, whether the ideas are useful to people in living their daily lives and of their own personal healing and of their own personal relationships with their families and their communities.
So common sense is what is the coin of the realm.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I know my grandparents lived in a suburb of Vicksburg, Mississippi, and they kind of lived off on a little spur road in the National Military Park down around Vicksburg. But in order for me to get to the local store, which is run by a Chinese family, I had to walk through a very poor black neighborhood where they had running water, but didn't have any plumbing, and just water in on the ground. And so you get some idea of the lifestyle there. But the thing, when I would sit down with these old black elders, the thing they kept pounding in my head was, look, son, we want you to remember, you've got book learning, but the thing that we value the most is common sense. And it just seems like every time I sat down with one of them, that was the message that they felt that I needed to hear. And it's underlined, and I guess this is what everything is coming back around to, is, and I can understand that the elders are probably elated that somebody's finally listening after 500 years.
Absolutely. And one of the things that strikes me the most is while you have all of these powerful, powerful Harvard academics, Berkeley academics, Princeton, Yale academics talking about the racial divides and the ethnic divides and the religious divides and so on and so forth, you sit down a black elder, you sit down a Hopi elder, you sit down an Aztec elder or a Mayan elder, a Tibetan Lama elder, and you observe them conversing, and they have the highest respect for each other. They are part of the same family. And it is only unfortunately, it is only in the Western academic tradition that you find this tremendous division of race. You know, one of the things that strikes me in American consciousness today is that there's a man by the name of Thomas Sowell. Thomas Sowell is hated by many of the political groups in the black community, but one of the reasons he's hated is because he doesn't go with the program, their program. He basically says, okay, look, if I see something, I'm going to call a spade a spade, and I'm going to say it the way I see it. And which is that, as you put it, the common sense coin of the realm. And he says, if we, he's of course talking to the American community, he says, if we continue to buy into this division that's pushed by the Western academic tradition along race and along religion and ethnicity, we are doing our own people a tremendous disservice. And that message reverberates in the native communities in Mexico, because they're saying exactly the same thing. When they raise the children and they teach them about life, they always go back to the original principle. We are all children of Mother Earth, and you must always respect other people and their beliefs. We have a mantra that we use I get involved in the teaching that I do. And it goes something like this. You start where you are with what you have, and you do the best you can. You believe strongly in yourself and your values, and you respect the right of others to believe differently. And that is a capsule of common sense. It's a capsule that if you ask anyone, Tibetan or Hopi or Mayan, or Dawat, or Wicho, whatever, and you ask them, what is their philosophy of life? And whatever words they use, they will generally go in that capsule. We have something to say, which is, we are all children of Mother Earth. We must all come together as one family. And we also respect other people's right to believe differently. And that key of respecting other people's right to believe differently other people out there that are different from me, then you're always going to find reasons to have conflict. But if you start off from a point of departure that everyone out there is my family, and we need to work through whatever differences we might have and respect each other's creativity and points of view, then you find ways in which you can work through problems, in which you can find peace in your relationships. And that, yeah, I think, is a very, very important message, and that is the message that anyway I bring, I try to express as strongly as I can, in the strongest terms and in the most loving way, is the message of the elders of the various communities that certainly that I'm involved in. And also to tell people that it's not enough to know this. Going back to this idea of what's within has to come outside and vice versa, it's not enough to know that we're one family, and it's not enough to be aware of the wisdom of the elders. You have to practice it. You have to get out there and do it. And whether that's in the political realm, whether that's in your family realm, or whether that's simply on a personal level, so pilgrimages or fasting or vision quests, it's just feeding that idea within yourself, feeding that feeling of commonality with others and of being one family of Mother Earth, and of respecting our place, not only on global terms on the Earth, but also our place in the universe, is something that has to be done. We have to do it in our actions, in the way we use our words, in the way we interact with other people.
Do the elders feel that getting the message through to the Nordamericanos is key because of how much resources these people up here in North America are consuming, and the rate that they're consuming it? You know, the message is great, and it would work if everybody would just think about someone other than, you know, who lives next door. You know, and this has been a real leap for me. I was brought up in one of the most conservative Republican homes, but you know, in a lot of ways, I'm a political conservative, and in a lot of ways, I was, I'm far to the left, and I guess this is what it comes down to, is that people need to choose what's best, not only for themselves, but for everyone. I used to think because the word was going around, we can't fall for this, you know, we're all interdependent and all this stuff, and this is all New Agey and it's communist and all this other kind of stuff. You know, it took me a few years to realize, hey, you know, something's got to be done, or, you know, Americans are going to eat this world up.
Well, you know, it's interesting because there are some ironies here. You know, oftentimes, of course, I make it a point to read what's being said about Mexicans and so on here in the United States, and oftentimes there's this kind of arrogance, this kind of chauvinism about Mexicans and in the broader terms, natives and so on and so forth. And yet, when I'm in the native communities, it's the exact opposite.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Friends, this is Will Bluewater. Would you think twice about defending yourself or a loved one from an intruder? In this day and age, would you dream of leaving your doors unlocked at night for fear of being burglarized or even attacked or worse? Would you? But when it comes to our own bodies, the doors to our houses are wide open all the time. The very air we breathe and the food we eat, especially here in the United States, creates free radicals that cause us to age and in some cases cause illness, some of which are deadly. Now, for the first time in history, there's a supplement called Protandim that is listed on the U.S. government's PubMed.gov website, with many peer-reviewed studies all showing that Protandim is a proven killer of the free radicals that are aging and in some cases even killing us. Now, I'm not talking about killing one molecule of free radical per one molecule of antioxidants like the stuff we've been taking. I'm talking about killing 1 million free radicals per second, per molecule. And this is the very same antioxidant your own body produces. Protandim supercharges your body to create much more than it does without Protandim. There's an old saying that we are warned about in the scriptures. That's the attitude, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. So let me ask you, how much money do you spend on food a day? If you're out shopping or at the beach, would you think anything of spending a buck or even more on a can of soda? If there was a vending machine that sold something that killed what was aging you or even killing you, would you even hesitate to spend a buck and a half a day? Well, now there is such a vending machine, and it's sitting right in front of you. It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
They have the highest admiration and respect for the achievements of Americans. I've talked to any number of elders who say, we find what the Americans have done so incredible and fantastic and so consistent. The ideals of the American government. In fact, something as simple that we take for granted, but Native Americans notice, that to set aside a day to give thanks to the Creator, thanks you. Well, to set a day aside to give thanks to the Creator is the single most important thing that America has contributed to the world.
Canada also, they just picked a Tuesday. But so the United States fulfilled a Nostradamus prophecy by picking a Thursday holiday.
Right. Well, that respect is there. And then technically, they look at the principles and the goals of democratic theory, and they say that to allow people a standing to everyone, regardless of, because it cuts across if anyone, black, Hispanic, whatever, can vote, women can vote, so on and so forth. It's just that democratizing of the idea that government should reflect everyone who lives within the boundaries of that system is another thing that they respect tremendously. So, there is no sense of hatred or chauvinism or whatever among the Native people towards Americans. In fact, they have the highest respect. And so it's kind of sad when, on the other hand, when I listen to the English speakers, look down on the Mexicans as seen through the prism of consumption as being poor and in labor and basically defensible. And on the other hand, the Natives admiring Americans so much.
That's the way the Cherokees looked at the Wai'suna first got here. We the Cherokees just loved them, and then they turned around and did what they did. But you know, that was an experience I guess we signed up for. But the South African blacks back during apartheid, they kept their mantra was, "Will the whites?" No, excuse me. Let me digress. Their mantra was, "Will we have turned from loving the whites when they turned from hating us?" And so the people in Mexico are still loving us up to this point. And I hope that goes on happening, because given the right set of circumstances and, any disaster here or there, and, the people in Mexico, could end with the history with the United States and past wars, there could be real conflicts, and I certainly hope not.
My own sense is that I don't foresee that there be real conflict. I mean, the amount of mutual self-interest is so great between the nation of Mexico and the United States that I just don't see that happening. It's just that we have too much in common. Certainly, people who understand Mexico on its own terms, people like myself, and who understand America on its own terms, people like myself, are that bridge, because oftentimes when Mexicans ask me, I don't understand why the United States went to Iraq, and is native, has native background, at least 35% of it is still native pure, who live in native community. And then you have basically like a 10% that is Europhile or European in background and who dominate the country.
Mm-hmm.
That having been said, I think we're moving in a direction that is going to determine whether we're going to be successful in creating a better world. And in order to do that, we need to recover. And as I said, this is going to be going back historically, but going forward to meeting our new place, the consciousness of the Jaguar, which is a consciousness of universality, which is a consciousness of everyone working together and recognizing each other as one family. That's basically the message, and it's a simple message, but it has tremendously powerful consequences.
Well, I just wish the movie makers up here would stop portraying, you know, Mexicans as macho drug runners, you know, because it makes me, you know, my people, my Cherokees migrated back and forth between what is now the United States and Mexico at least two times. Our wampum belts are tied with Mexican seaweed. But when I think about crossing the border to go down to Coahuila, you know, to visit the people that left here in 1721 and the place where Tequila went down to and died, you know, I'm a little bit afraid. You know, I'm from up here. I don't know the language. And, you know, the policia at the daytime, you know, they're going to be the banditos at night. You know, am I going to be safe?
Well, Luardo, one of the things that a lot of people don't understand the history of Mexico, that the government was set up in 1521 with the idea of simply raising the country. The government said, first of all, let me take a step back. People need to understand there were about 7 million people that is estimated in this continent in late 1400s, early 1600s. And within a space of 25 years, that population went down to approximately 3 million people throughout the continent. And the reason for that was simple: smallpox.
Right.
You know, the Western history books love to write about how this intrepid band, you know, 10 Spaniards, conquering millions of Indians. The truth of it is that the minute they landed, the smallpox virus started spreading so quickly and decimated the population so quickly that in the space of a blink of an eye, which was approximately about a year from the point that Cortez landed in Veracruz, basically you decimated 80% of the population.
Mm.
And so, then they installed the government after they destroyed the Tenochtitlan, which is the capital of the Aztec Empire at that point. They installed this government whose sole purpose was the collection of gold, silver, and jewels that were in that in the countryside. And all of the internal organization, what was left of the internal organization of the Aztec, was used exclusively to extract the wealth of the country. That continues to exist today.
Hmm.
The government of Mexico, central government of Mexico, is a very, very centralized government whose sole purpose is to extract the wealth of its people. There's no secret. 300 families in Mexico control 90% of the country's wealth.
Also, the same thing going on down there is going on up here, basically.
So when you go to Mexico and you say the policia is part of that institutional apparatus that keeps everyone under control. And the Catholic Church, you know, my grandparents were Catholic, so they were very, very, from a philosophical standpoint, were very Christian, very oriented towards Jesus. Of course, to Virgen de Guadalupe, which is the most powerful icon in Mexico today. But everyone recognizes the role of the church. allow the naming of a native child, period. Until, in fact, it was so astonishing to me. I went to the community, see the baby, I asked, what's his name? It doesn't have a name. I go, what do you mean it doesn't have a name? How can it not have a name? No, no, it doesn't have a name. I don't understand. Please explain it to me. I'm not getting it. And I go, I'm sorry. It's just that we're not allowed to name the baby. The priest has to come and give the name, give a baby the Christian name, whatever that is, Jose, Juan, or whatever. That's why the big joke in Mexico is everybody's either Maria, Jose, or Juan, or Jaime even. And so that's because those are the names given by the church. It's kind of a generic naming. And until the priest says that is its name, then we are not allowed to name it today. And so if you have this government on the one hand that's set up to basically extract the wealth of the country and to benefit those few families that control it, and then you have a religious apparatus whose only purpose in the native communities is to create a cultural genocide and make everybody European, Euro-Christian, then you have a sense of what the native peoples are facing. And so for natives to then learn Spanish and begin to kind of put their ideas into practice, they have to hide a lot of the forms and a lot of the philosophy under a Christian rubric. And to give you an example, when you participate in a Huicho ceremony, for example, you will see a lot of elements in what we call altars, or the kind of way that I was referring to, but in Spanish they're called altars because the church has altars. And so rather than referring it to a central place where you have sacred things, which is the Caliway, of course you call it an altar. And in almost every altar, you will see a Christian cross. And any of the elders will, when they start their ceremony, they will pick up a Christian cross. And they will kiss it and venerate it and do all of those sorts of movements in the traditional way with a Christian cross. Because everyone who's observing is observing to see if, in fact, they are, quote, loyal to whoever the powers that be. And then once they've gone through the process of saying, you know, well, we've worked with the cross, we're doing all the sacred movements with the cross and so on, even some of the candles that are required or that the elders will ask for their ceremonies will be the wax candles, called cirios, that are found in the Catholic Church. So that if the priest arrives and says, okay, what are you guys doing here? Well, we're having a ceremony, and they'll see the cross, and they'll see the Lady of Guadalupe, and they'll see the church candles, and he'll see all of the elements that he expects to see that are consistent with the Catholic Church. Then it's okay, now you can continue with your, I'm sorry, I did most of the thing. Anyway,
we'll
continue with the ceremony. If they don't have those elements, they shut the ceremony down. So many people get the mistaken notion when they go to some of these native ceremonies and they see all of these Christian icons. They get the mistaken notion that they've all converted. But this is the only way that the elders are able to transmit the cultural knowledge to the community, is by this overlay, Christian overlay. I'll give you one more example of that. There's another community that I had occasion to study very in depth, and they have a church. Has never had a priest. The church is not considered them important enough to have a priest because they're a relatively small, numerically small community. So I visited the church, and when you walk in, find that while they respect Jesus and the Christian program, because out of their own nature, intrinsic nature, that you respect all other beliefs, still hidden within that worship, you will find that they are carrying those traditions that come from way back and will continue into the future.
Well, I'm glad to see that Hunab Ku is alive and well.
And thriving.
I'm glad to see it. You know, a lot of the same thing went on up here, you know, before the Native American Religious Freedom Act. You know, they did their ceremonies in secret. If they got caught, they went to jail, but they didn't care. And that really gratifies me to hear that.
Absolutely. It's thriving, and they're holding on to the tradition. But they're facing tremendous challenges. And, well, yeah, so I think one other thing that is worth saying, for those in your audience who may be not familiar, my intention in my book, which was my first attempt, I'm in the middle of the second book now with a great deal more detail, is to say that I'm not trying to put wings on anyone. I'm not saying that Native communities are free of all the perversity that other human groups, are guilty of. No, we have good and bad in everyone. And in many of the Native communities, certainly in the United States and in Mexico, alcoholism is a tremendous problem. Despair is a tremendous problem. Now, increasingly, drugs are a tremendous problem. And the reason is that you have an unraveling of that traditional system. I mean, think about it. If you are trying to educate your own family, you educate those that come after you, and you're having to hide the way you're educating them because your school system is teaching them something totally different, your church is teaching them something totally different, the government is organized to brainwash you in a completely different way. The success of you being able to hold on to what you know and to keep your children protected is going to, it's going to have some problems. And there are some communities where, half of the population is in total despair. So this is not to suggest that Natives have some sort of, special gift of being angels, or to suggest there are no problems. The problems are many and severe. The only purpose of my work is to tell people, if you look closely enough at these communities, and if you listen to their elders that are still alive and well today, they have something to say. And whether you agree or you don't agree or you want them to all disappear, the fact of the matter is they have something to contribute to the general knowledge and philosophy of the world. And so listen and allow them to express what they have in their hearts. That's all.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
You want to get an edge on turning back the clock with just a few pills? Who doesn't? Well, it's no longer science fiction, but science possibility, a potential breakthrough. As I found out firsthand, there may be a way to erase years, at least inside my body. Granted, it's down the road, but some scientists are wondering if a new pill I took might offer a very long life.
It may not look like the Fountain of Youth, but inside this nondescript building, I'm about to become part of an exciting experiment, a kind of guinea pig.
Dr. McCord, okay.
I'm here at the University of Colorado in Denver to meet Dr. Joe McCord, a world-renowned scientist.
This is pretty exciting stuff you're finding, huh?
It is. We're very excited about it.
His latest research could very well unravel the mystery of aging itself. And his decades of experiments may have the potential of adding years to people's lives and possibly prevent chronic diseases like cancer, diabetes, and heart disease. It all centers around this small yellow pill, and for me, it begins with a blood test.
There we go.
It wouldn't be the first time I've given blood for this company.
They want to check my levels of something called T-bars, which is a rough indicator of a person's actual age. T-bars can identify a condition known as oxidative stress, a kind of measure of the wear and tear on our bodies. Oxidative stress, like the rusting of an engine, is not a good thing.
Bad for the body.
Leading to disease.
Leading to disease and leading to malfunction, and importantly, leading to what we call aging. It is a slow progression of increasing oxidative stress. That's the main characteristic biochemically of the aging process.
The problem of aging begins with the very food we eat to give us energy. As our cells burn that food, they also release toxic chemicals. Those chemicals, you may know them as free radicals, react with all the components of our cells, literally bombarding them millions of times per second, damaging all our cells. The result? Oxidative stress, and we all have it. The body fights back with a system of defenses. It makes two antioxidant enzymes, catalase and SOD, whose job is to gobble up the free radicals before they can harm our cells.
So, doctor, how often do I take these?
And so, here I go. With that swallow, I've just become part of a potentially landmark scientific experiment.
Doesn't taste bad.
It's called Protandim, and tests on both mice and humans have already shown that it revs up the manufacture of those good enzymes in our bodies. More enzymes, fewer free radicals to harm us. Whether that will lead to longer life is still unknown. Experiments to see if mice live longer are about to get underway, but it's a tantalizing theory.
Right now, all we know is that this preparation decreases oxidative stress. Oxidative stress is not a disease, just like aging is not in itself a disease, but it's something that accompanies and is attached to many disease processes. So you can see the age-related...
Normally, oxidative stress, measured by those T-bars, increases with age. But in Dr. McCord's tests, taking just one pill of Protandim a day reversed that trend for everyone at every age, even for an 80-year-old.
They all are reduced to the level of oxidative stress that one would expect, frankly, in a newborn or a very young child.
Back to the oxidative stress levels of a child? It sounds too good to be true. Will Protandim work on me?
The scientific evidence is there. The pieces seem to make sense. The question is, does this translate into something that humans can take advantage of?
And so, ancient Eastern healing and modern Western medicine may soon be working together. High oxidative stress is associated with more than aging. It's been linked to hundreds of illnesses.
It's at the very center of many diseases. Liver disease, diabetes, emphysema, asthma. I've studied all of these. Strokes, heart attacks.
Even mental disease.
Yes.
Depression?
Alzheimer's disease, depression.
Dr. James Crapo with the National Jewish Medical Center in Denver is also researching Protandim for the company.
Are you saying that this could be a cure-all?
You're looking at something will have a small impact, but an important impact.
We make no claims about curing any disease or preventing any disease. We hope that when enough studies are done, perhaps such claims might be able to be made in the future.
Clinical studies to assess Protandim in both diabetes and heart disease should start in 3 to 4 months. But what about my progress? After nearly 2 weeks now, it's time to get my results. Dr. McCord calculates the numbers. The result? My level of oxidative stress has declined dramatically.
45%. That's excellent.
Just look at where I fall on the graph, before and after.
Which, if extrapolated back, is the level you would see in a newborn baby.
Have we turned back the clock? Well, maybe not on the outside, but deep inside, within my cells, yes indeed.
Would you suggest I keep taking this supplement?
I would. I can't guarantee it's going to extend your life. I can't guarantee it's going to eliminate any diseases or cure any diseases.
But we do know that oxidative stress is part of those disease processes. I don't want to wait until I'm 80 years old and find out that I should have taken it.
For more, go to our website at abcnews.com.
Major universities and government agencies initiated and continue self-funded studies following the ABC Primetime Investigative Report you just viewed that originally aired in 2005. These studies continue to reveal more scientific evidence about Protandim's unique benefits. They are published in major scientific and medical journals. The next video will bring you up to date.
Developed after 40 years of research and exclusively for LifeVantage, Protandim is a true scientific breakthrough in anti-aging. Protandim has been reported on ABC, NBC, and PBS featured in the Wall Street Journal and described in CNN chief medical correspondent Dr. Sanjay Gupta's book, Chasing Life, The Quest for Immortality. Protandim's creator, Dr. Joe McCord, is a world-renowned scientist and a pioneer in free radical biology. Dr. McCord is the discoverer of the key anti-aging enzyme, superoxide dismutase. His role in the discovery is so significant, the enzyme is measured in McCord units. For Dr. McCord's discovery of superoxide dismutase and his contributions in free radical biology, he was awarded the Elliott Cresson Medal. This medal is awarded to distinguished inventors and scientists, putting Dr. McCord in the same company as Pierre and Marie Curie, Alexander Graham Bell, Orville Wright, and Henry Ford. Dr. Joe McCord has devoted his life's work to the study of free radicals, their role in aging, and the many problems associated with aging. Consumers spend billions every year on antioxidants in the form of food and supplements, hoping to reduce these free radicals. But antioxidants from these sources can only eliminate one free radical for every one antioxidant molecule you consume. Protandim is scientifically proven to slow cellular damage caused by free radicals. Taking one Protandim one time per day for 30 days turns on these anti-aging enzymes in your body. Your own enzymes eliminate free radicals at a rate of 1 million to 1.
I think any other supplements that are designed to be antioxidant supplements probably are no longer needed because Protandim solves that problem in a much more effective way.
Protandim is a breakthrough poised to revolutionize the anti-aging industry. It is an entirely new and scientifically validated way to fight aging, reducing your oxidative stress levels to that of a 20-year-old after just 30 days.
We found, as many other scientists had documented, that there is a progressive increase in T-bars in your blood the older you get. When these same people took Protandim for 30 days, the age-dependent increase in lipid peroxidation was completely eliminated. After Protandim, we could no longer distinguish the 80-year-old from the 20-year-old.
Protandim is protected by three U.S. patents. Universities around the world continue to initiate and fund their own studies of Protandim and to evaluate how this anti-aging breakthrough can prevent and improve many of the hundreds of problems associated with aging.
Many academic scientists at a number of universities have begun studying Protandim because it represents a new tool. It represents a way of reducing oxidative stress that wasn't available before. Simply was not a good way of doing what Protandim does. Protandim interacts with the DNA in your cells and causes the cells to make more of a set of genes called survival genes. The ingredients in Protandim were actually selected because they are largely metabolized by the liver, which does not interfere with most prescription drugs, which are generally metabolized by the kidneys. So the general answer to that is yes, it is safe. The immediate benefits of Protandim are within several days, the biochemical markers of oxidative stress begin to decrease. And while these are immediate improvements, you may not sense that these things are happening, just as you can't sense what your cholesterol level is, if it's high or low. But nonetheless, these benefits start happening within days of taking Protandim. The advantages to taking Protandim in the long term are that it protects your body from the relentless progression of free radical damage as we age. The anti-aging aspect of Protandim is one that accumulates over time. So the longer you take it, the more protection you will sustain. Missing a dose of Protandim is not a big problem. It takes about 2 weeks for the effects to go away. So if you miss it for 2 weeks, you're pretty much back to where you started from.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
They have the highest admiration and respect for the achievements of Americans. I've talked to any number of elders who say, we find what the Americans have done so incredible and fantastic and so consistent. The ideals of the American government. In fact, something as simple that we take for granted, but Native Americans notice, that to set aside a day to give thanks to the Creator, thank you. Well, to set a day aside to give thanks to the Creator is the single most important thing that America has contributed to the world.
Canada also, they just picked a Tuesday. But so the United States fulfilled a Nostradamus prophecy by picking a Thursday holiday.
Right. Well, that perspective there. And then technically, they look at the principles and the goals of democratic theory, and they say that to allow people a standing to everyone, regardless of standing, because it cuts across if anyone, black, Hispanic, whatever, can vote, women can vote, so on and so forth. It's just that democratizing of the idea that government should reflect everyone who lives within the boundaries of that system is another thing that they respect tremendously. So, there is no sense of hatred or chauvinism or whatever among the Native people towards Americans. In fact, they have the highest respect. And so it's kind of sad when, on the other hand, when I listen to the English speakers, look down on the Mexicans seen through the prism of consumption as being poor and in labor and basically dispensable. And on the other hand, the natives admiring Americans so much.
That's the way the Cherokees looked at the wife when they first got here. The Cherokees just loved them, and then they turned around and did what they did. But that was the experience I guess we signed up for. But the South African blacks back during apartheid, they kept their mantra was, "Will the whites?" No, excuse me, let me digress. Their mantra was, "Will we have turned from loving the whites when they turn from hating us?" And so the people in Mexico are still loving us up to this point. And I hope that goes on happening because, given the right set of circumstances and, any disaster here or there, and, the people in Mexico, could, and with the history with the United States and past wars, there could be real conflicts, and I certainly hope not.
My own sense is that I don't foresee that there be real conflict. I think the amount of mutual self-interest is so great between the nation of Mexico and the United States that I just don't see that happening. It's just that we have too much in common. Certainly, people who understand Mexico on its own terms, people like myself, and who understand America on its own terms, people like myself, are that bridge because oftentimes when Mexicans ask, I don't understand why the United States is doing what's in Iraq, and I give them a kind of consciousness of the Jaguar, which is a consciousness of universality, which is a consciousness of everyone working together and recognizing each other as one family. That's basically the message. It's a simple message, but it has tremendously powerful consequences.
Well, I just wish the movie makers up here would stop portraying, you know, Mexicans as macho drug runners, you know, because it makes me, you know, my people, my Cherokee migrated back and forth between what is now the United States and Mexico at least two times. Our wampum belts are tied with Mexican seaweed, but when I think about crossing the border to go down to Coahuila, you know, to visit the people that left here in 1721 and the place where Tikoya went down to and died. You know, I'm a little bit afraid. You know, I'm from up here. I don't know the language. And, you know, the policia at the daytime, you know, are they going to be the bandidos at night? You know, am I going to be safe?
Well, Bluewater, one of the things that a lot of people understand the history of Mexico is that the government was set up in 1521 with the idea of simply raising the government. But people need to understand there were about 70 million people, it is estimated, in this continent in the late 1400s, early 1500s. And within a space of 25 years, that population went down to approximately 3 million people throughout the continent. And the reason for that was simple. Smallpox.
Right.
You know, the Western history books love to write about how this intrepid band of, you know, 10 Spaniards conquered. The truth of it is that the minute they landed, the smallpox virus started spreading so quickly and decimated the population so quickly that in a space of a blink of an eye, which is approximately about a year from the point that Cortez landed in Veracruz, basically you decimated 80% of the population.
Mm.
And so then they installed a government after they destroyed the Tenochtitlan plan, which is the capital of the Aztec Empire at that point. They installed this government whose sole purpose was the collection of gold, silver, and jewels that were in the countryside. And all of the internal organization, what was left of the internal organization of the Aztec, was used exclusively to extract the wealth of the country. That continues to exist today. The government of Mexico, central government of Mexico, is a very, very centralized government whose sole purpose is to extract the wealth of its people. There's no secret. 300 families in Mexico control 90% of the country's wealth.
Also, the same thing going on down there is going on up here, basically.
So when you go to Mexico and you say the policia is part of that institutional apparatus that keeps everyone under control. And the Catholic Church, you know, my grandparents were Catholic, so they were very, very from a philosophical standpoint, were very Christian, very oriented toward Jesus. Of course, to Virgen de Guadalupe, which is the most powerful icon in Mexico today. But everyone recognizes the role of the Church. And in my book, in one of the chapters, I describe the ways the Church has been complicit in the genocide of many of the native communities.
Mm-hmm.
Because you cannot, in some native communities today, you cannot name a child with an Indian name. You have to give them a, quote, Christian or European name.
Wow.
Unquote. And so you have a process in which church today, I'm not talking about, you know, 200 years ago, today, I'm talking about when I wrote this book, I had gone, that was about 3 years ago, so in the year 2000, you have in areas of Nayarit and Durango and Zacatecas, you've got the church will not allow the naming of a native child, period, until, in fact, it was so astonishing to me. I went to the community, see the baby, I asked, what's his name? It doesn't have a name. I go, what do you mean it doesn't have a name? How can it not have a name? No, it doesn't have a name. I don't understand. Please explain it to me. I'm not getting it. And they go, I'm sorry. It's just that we're not allowed to name the baby. The priest has to come and give the name. baby, the Christian name, whatever that is, Jose or Juan or whatever. That's why the big joke in Mexico is with everybody, either Maria, Jose, or Juan, or Jaime even. And so that's because those are the names given by the church. It's kind of a generic naming. And until the priest says that is its name, then we are not allowed to name it today. And so if you have this government on the one hand that's set up to basically extract the wealth of the country and to benefit those few families that control it, and then you have a religious apparatus whose only purpose in the native communities is to create a cultural genocide and make everybody European, Euro-Christian, then you have a sense of what the native peoples are facing. And so for natives to then learn Spanish and begin to kind of put their ideas into practice, they have to hide a lot of the forms and a lot of their philosophy under a Christian rubric. And to give you an example, when you participate in a Huicho ceremony, for example, you will see a lot of elements in what we call altars, or the Caliway that I was referring to, but in Spanish they're called altars because the church has altars. And so rather than referring it to a central place where you have sacred things, which is the Caliway, of course you call it an altar. And in almost every altar, you will see a Christian cross, and many of the elders will, when they start their ceremony, they will pick up a Christian cross, and they will kiss it and venerate it and do all of those sorts of movements in the traditional way with a Christian cross, because everyone who's observing is observing to see if, in fact, they are, quote, loyal to whoever the powers that be. And then once they've gone through the process of saying, you know, well, we've worked with the cross, we're doing all the sacred movements with the cross and so on, even some of the candles that are required or that the elders will ask for their ceremonies will be the wax candles, it's called cirios, that are found in the Catholic Church. So that if the priest arrives and says, okay, what are you guys doing here? Well, we're having a ceremony, and he'll see the cross, and he'll see the Lady of Guadalupe, and he'll see the church candles, and he'll see all of the elements that he expects to see that are consistent with the Catholic Church. Then it's okay, now you can continue with your, I'm sorry, is it most of the time?
Anyway,
we'll continue with a ceremony. If they don't have those elements, they shut the ceremony down. So many people get the mistaken notion when they go to some of these native ceremonies and they see all of these Christian icons. They get the mistaken notion that they've all converted. But this is the only way that the elders are able to transmit the cultural knowledge of the community, is by this overlay, Christian overlay. I'll give you one more example of that. There's another community that I had occasion to study very in depth, and they have a church. Has never had a priest. The church is not considered as important enough to have a priest because they're a relatively small, numerically small community. And so I visited the church, and when you walk in, you see all of the Christ, leading Christ, carrying the cross, very, very kind of powerfully bloody Christian icons as you walk in and so on and so forth. And so when the local elder realized that where we were coming from, that in fact we were working with the native tradition, then he says, come with me. And he took us to the altar in front of the little church. There's an altar, of course, where the priest does the mass and so on. And they moved the respect Jesus and the Christian program because out of their own nature, intrinsic nature, that you respect all other beliefs, still hidden within that worship, you will find that they are carrying those traditions that come from way back and will continue into the future.
Well, I'm glad to see that Hunab Ku is alive and well.
And thriving.
I'm glad to see it. You know, a lot of the same thing went on up here, you know, before the Native American Religious Freedom Act. You know, they did their ceremonies in secret. If they got caught, they went to jail, but they didn't care. And that really gratifies me to hear that.
Absolutely. It's thriving, and they're holding on to the tradition. But they're facing tremendous challenges. And I think one of the things that's worth saying, for those in your audience who may be not familiar, my intention in my book, which was my first attempt, I'm in the middle of the second book now with a great deal more detail, is to say that I'm not trying to put wings on anyone. I'm not saying that Native communities are free of all the perversity that other human groups are guilty of. No, we have good and bad in everyone, and in many of the Native communities, certainly in the United States and in Mexico, alcoholism is a tremendous problem. Despair is a tremendous problem. Now, increasingly, drugs are a tremendous problem. And the reason is that you have an unraveling of that traditional system. I mean, think about it. If you are trying to educate your own family, you educate those that come after you, and you're having to hide the way you're educating them because your school system is teaching them something totally different, your church is teaching them something totally different, the government is organized brainwash you in a completely different way. The success of you being able to hold on to what you know and to keep your children protected is going to, it's going to have some problems. And there are some communities where, half of the population is in total despair. So this is not to suggest that Natives have some sort of, special gift of being angels, or to suggest there are no problems. The problems are many and severe. The only purpose of my work is to tell people, if you look closely enough at these communities, and if you listen to their elders that are still alive and well today, they have something to say. And whether you agree or you don't agree or you want them to all disappear, the fact of the matter is they have something to contribute to the general knowledge and philosophy of the world. And so, listen. Listen and allow them to express what they have in their hearts.
Well, I cannot even imagine. And just for example, last night, you did a show last night that was 90 minutes starting at 7:30.
That's right.
Then you went through that. Then you came here. You're here this morning.
That's right.
Doing all of this.
It's nonstop. I don't sleep anymore.
No. All right. So where do you get the energy? Seriously. I mean, look at you.
Well,
I mean, we've known each other a long time.
Yeah.
We've passed. You don't ever get older.
Well, thank you. It's quite funny because, people are kind of shocked when they hear that I'm 54 years old, and they say, how do you keep your youth? I have found something, Dr. Phil, that I think is the closest thing to the fountain of youth.
Oh, you do have a secret.
I have a secret, and I've never really talked about it. Well, I've been doing this for the last 2 years. It's called Protandem, and it works. And I'm telling everybody about this.
You feel differently.
I do.
Because you're running around like a chicken with your head cut off.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you're hitting the times. You're getting where you're supposed to be.
I have
you're
to be on the spot all the time.
Now, I've got three sisters, and we get along great 1,500 miles apart. I cannot imagine.
It takes me 1,600 miles.
Yeah, but I can't imagine working with my sister every day. What do you do when you have disagreements? Because you have to have disagreements, right? Because
well,
you're both producers.
Yeah, we're both producers, and that's typical because we're both type A. And you're going to butt heads. What's really interesting about the Donnie Marie duo is that it doesn't really matter how much we butt the heads when that curtain goes.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
They have the highest admiration and respect for the achievements of Americans. I've talked to any number of elders who say we find what the Americans have done so incredible and fantastic and so consistent
Canada also, they just picked a Tuesday. But so the United States fulfilled a Nostradamus prophecy by picking a Thursday holiday.
Right. Well, that perspective there. And then secondly, they look at the principles and the goals of democratic theory, and they say that to allow people a standing to everyone, regardless of standing, because it cuts across if anyone's black, Hispanic, whatever, can vote, women can vote, so on and so forth. It's just that democratizing of the idea that government should reflect everyone who lives within the boundaries of that system is another thing that they respect tremendously. So, there is no sense of hatred or chauvinism or whatever among the native people towards Americans. In fact, they have the highest respect. And so it's kind of sad when, on the other hand, when I listen to the English speakers, look down on the Mexicans as seen through the prism of consumption as being poor and in labor and basically dispensable. And on the other hand, the natives admiring Americans so much.
That's the way the Cherokees looked at the Waiso neighbors got here. The Cherokees just loved them. And then they turned around and did what they did. That was an experience I guess we signed up for. But, the South African blacks back during apartheid, they kept, their mantra was, Their mantra was, will we have turned from loving the whites when they turned from hating us? And so the people in Mexico are still loving us up to this point. And I hope that goes on happening because, given the right set of circumstances and, any disaster here or there, and, the people in Mexico, could end with the history with the United States and past wars, there could be real conflicts, and I certainly hope not.
My own sense is that I don't foresee that there be real conflict. I think the amount of mutual self-interest is so great between the nation of Mexico and the United States that I just don't see that happening. It's just that we have too much in common. Certainly, people who understand Mexico on its own terms, people like myself, and who understand America on its own terms, people like myself, are that bridge because oftentimes when Mexicans ask me, I don't understand why the United States is doing what it's doing in Iraq, and I give them a kind of a glimpse of the internal politics. They understand. They understand that there's different forces in the United States, different interest groups that have certain agendas. They know that it's not all Americans that believe this, that, or the other. And in the same way, when I speak to American audiences, I tell them, look, Mexico is an Indian country, and many people still do not understand that the great majority of Mexico is native, has native backgrounds. At least 35% of it is still native pure who live in a native community. And then you have basically like a 10% that is Europhile or European in background and who dominate the country. That having been said, I think we're moving in a direction that is going to determine whether we're going to be successful in creating a better world. And in order to do that, we need to recover. And as I said, this isn't really going back historically, but going forward to meeting our new place, the consciousness of the Jaguar, which is the consciousness of universality, which is the consciousness of everyone working together and recognizing each other as one family. That's basically the message, and it's a simple message, but it has tremendously powerful consequences.
Well, I just wish the movie makers up here would stop portraying, Mexicans as macho drug runners, because it may be, my people, my Cherokee migrated back and forth between what is now the United States and Mexico at least two times. Our wampum belts are tied with Mexican seaweed, But when I think about crossing the border to go down to Coahuila, you know, to visit the people that left here in 1721 and the place where Tikoya went down to and died, you know, I'm a little bit afraid. You know, I'm from up here. I don't know the language. And, you know, the policia at the daytime, you know, are they going to be the bandidos at night? You know, am I going to be safe?
Well, Blue Otter, one of the things that a lot of people don't understand the history of Mexico is that the government was set up in 1521 with the idea of simply raising the country. The government said, turn to all of them and take a step back. People need to understand there were about 70 million people that is estimated in this continent in late 1400s, early 1500s. And within a space of 25 years, that population went down to approximately 3 million people throughout the continent. And the reason for that was simple: smallpox.
Right.
You know, the Western history books love to write about how this intrepid band of, you know, 10 Spaniards conquered millions of Indians. The truth of it is that the minute they landed, the smallpox virus started spreading so quickly and decimated the population so quickly that in a space of a blink of an eye, which was approximately about a year from the point that Cortez landed in Veracruz, basically you decimated 80% of the population.
Mm.
And so then they installed the government after they destroyed the Tenochtitlan, which is the capital of the Aztec Empire at that point. They installed this government whose sole purpose was the collection of gold, silver, and jewels that were in that in the countryside, and all of the internal organization, what was left of the internal organization of the Aztec, was used exclusively to extract the wealth of the country. That continues to exist today. The government of Mexico, central government of Mexico, is a very, very centralized government whose sole purpose is to extract the wealth of its people. There's no secret. 300 families in Mexico control 90% of the country's wealth.
Also, the same thing is going on down there is going on up here, basically.
Well, so when you go to Mexico and you say the policia is part of that institutional apparatus that keeps everyone under control. And the Catholic Church, you know, my grandparents were Catholic, so they were very, very from a philosophical standpoint, were very Christian, very oriented toward Jesus. Of course, to Virgen de Guadalupe, which is the most powerful icon in Mexico today, but everyone recognizes the role of the church. And in my book, in one of the chapters, I describe the way that the church has been complicit in the genocide of many of the native communities.
Mm-hmm.
Because you cannot, in some native communities today, you cannot name a child with an Indian name. You have to give them a, quote, Christian or European name.
Wow.
Unquote. And so you have a process in which church today, I'm not talking about 200 years ago, I'm talking about when I wrote this book, I had gone, that was about 3 years ago, so in the year 2000, you have in areas of Nayarit and Durango and Zacatecas, you've got the church will not allow the naming of a native child, period, until, in fact, it was so astonishing to me. I went to the community, see the baby. I asked, what's his name? It doesn't have a name. I go, what do you mean it doesn't have a name? How can it not have a name? Oh, no, it doesn't have a name. I don't understand. Please explain it to me. I'm not getting it. And they go, I'm sorry. It's just that we're not allowed to name the baby. The priest has to come and give the name, give a baby the Christian name, whatever that is, Jose or Juan or whatever. That's why the big joke in Mexico is everybody is either Maria, Jose, or Juan, or Jaime even. And so that's because those are the names given by the church. It's kind of like a generic naming. And until the priest says that is its name, then we are not allowed to name it today. And so if you have this government on the one hand that's set up to basically extract the wealth of the country and to benefit those few families that control it, and then you have a religious apparatus whose only purpose in the native communities is philosophy under a Christian rubric. And to give you an example, when you participate in a Wicho ceremony, for example, you will see a lot of elements in what we call altars. It was the kind of way that I was referring to, but in Spanish they're called altars because the church has altars. And so rather than referring it to a central place where you have sacred things, which are in the Kali Way, of course you call it an altar. And in almost every altar, you will see a Christian cross. And many of the elders will, when they start their ceremony, they will pick up a Christian cross. And they will kiss it and venerate it and do all of those sorts of movements in the traditional way with a Christian cross. Because everyone who's observing is observing the deity. In fact, they are, quote, loyal to whoever the powers of being. And then once they've gone through the process of saying, you know, well, we've worked with the cross, we're doing all the sacred movements with the cross and so on, even some of the candles that are required or that the elders will ask for their ceremonies will be the wax candles, called sirios, that are found in the Catholic Church. So that if the priest arrives and says, okay, what are you guys doing here? Well, we're having a ceremony, and you'll see the cross, and you'll see the Lady of Guadalupe, and you'll see the church candles, and you'll see all of the elements that he expects to see that are consistent with the Catholic Church. Then it's okay, now you can continue with your, I'm sorry, is it close to the train? Anyway,
we'll
continue with the ceremony. If they don't have those elements, they shut the ceremony down. So many people get the mistaken notion when they go to some of these native ceremonies and they see all of these Christian icons. They get the mistaken notion that they've all converted. But this is the only way that the elders are able to transmit the cultural knowledge of the community is by this overlay, Christian overlay. I'll give you one more example of that. There's another community that I had occasion to study very in depth, and they have a church. Has never had a priest. The church is not considered as important enough to have a priest because they're a relatively small, numerically small community. And so I visited the church, and when you walk in, you see all of the Christ, leading Christ, carrying the cross, you know, very, very kind of powerfully bloody Christian icons as you walk in and so on and so forth. And so when the local elder realized that where we were coming from, that in fact we were working with the native tradition, then he says, come with me. And he took us to the altar in front of the little church. There's an altar, of course, where the priest does the mass and so on. And they moved the table where the priest would officiate the mass. And under the table, there was this a hidden compartment. And there, you had all of the icons that represented the philosophy of that particular native community. And so all of the natives would come to the church and understand that when they were doing their worship for the purpose of the priest and for the purposes of the bishop, and so everybody could see that they're with the Catholic program, with the Christian program, then when those priests would leave, then they would pull out their candles and their icons and their elements, their staff, their feathers, all of those sorts of things, out of that hidden compartment, put it in the altar or the Kali Way, and then they would have their singing and their dance and their rituals consistent with their true belief system. So Mexico, being the most Catholic country in the world, you will have seen, and there's another chapter in my book where I talk about the visit of Pope John Paul. You get the impression everyone's Catholic and everyone's with a Christian program. But if you dig a little deeper, you find that while they respect Jesus and the Christian program, because out of their own nature, intrinsic nature, that you respect all other beliefs, still hidden within that worship, you will find that they are carrying those traditions that come from way back and will continue into the future.
Well, I'm glad to see that Hunab Ku is alive and well.
And thriving.
I'm glad to see it. You know, a lot of the same thing went on up here, you know, before the Native American Religious Freedom Act. You know, they did their ceremonies in secret. If they got caught, they went to jail, but they didn't care. And that really gratifies me to hear that.
Absolutely. It's thriving, and they're holding on to the tradition. But they're facing tremendous challenges. And I think one other thing that is
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
Last night, it's funny you should ask
that.
Did
you tally?
706, I think, was last.
706.
Yeah.
How do you find the energy to keep doing it night after night?
Oh, well, now it's the show evolves. You know, Marie and I change it up every once in a while, and so it keeps it fun, it keeps it exciting. The audience last night was just amazing. They were just, I love hecklers. I love when I do.
People heckle you?
Well, yeah.
Kind of, just to kind of get a reaction.
For fun. There's interaction with the audience, and I love that because it just changes it up a little bit and keeps it fresh.
Keeps it.
And the band, we probably have the best band in Las Vegas.
How many numbers do you think you do on the show?
Oh, I don't know.
It rotates out all the time.
Yeah, it changes constantly. I do this number called Yo-Yo, and the dancing, it was a hit we had back in the early 70s, and we do all this dancing. It just wears me out. It's my cardio for the day.
Well, you were the Dancing with the Stars champion in 2009. Where is your mirror ball trophy?
It's in the lobby of the Flamingo.
It is?
Yeah, it's in a glass case so Marie doesn't steal it.
I have not seen it. I have to go by there and check it out.
Yes.
And, you know, every time my brother stays at the Bellagio, he says you're staring at him.
I am. The big Donnie and Marie picture on the wall. Yes.
Is that weird driving by and seeing that every single time?
I call it my ego picture. If ever I'm feeling bad, I just drive past the front and look at it and say, that's me.
It's a pick-me-up. And you're going on tour to the UK and doing a holiday concert as well.
That's right.
When is that happening?
Well, that's the UK is going to be in January. Then we go to Los Angeles and Phoenix and Salt Lake City for the Christmas tour in December.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nonstop.
It is. And you do your radio show as well.
Radio show, yeah.
And then also you know, we get a lot of comments. So people have been emailing me and saying they love how you look. Like, you're ageless. It's incredible. So
I have a secret.
What is your secret?
I have a secret formula, and it's a company called LifeVantage. They came up with a product called Protandem. Now, what causes the aging process is free radicals in our body, oxidative stress.
Mm-hmm.
This Protandem stuff, I've been taking it for 2 years.
We have it on the table right
clinically there. Proven to slow the aging process down. It reduces the oxidative stress by 40% in 30 days.
That's your secret.
I said, whatever, you know. So I tested it, and it works. And the nice thing, it's not pharmaceutical. It's it's real food.
I'm going to have to give it a try.
Oh, you don't need it. You look beautiful.
I want it, for sure.
But it works for me. I'm 94 years old.
I'm looking fabulous. And you know what? Your son is here with you. He made a big announcement yesterday, too.
That's right. He's going to have a baby. Well, his wife's going to have a baby. My fifth grandchild.
Your fifth grandchild. How many kids do you have, really quickly?
42 that I know.
Do you keep a GPS tracking device on all of them?
Yeah, sure. No, I have five wonderful boys, and three of them are married, and five grandkids.
It's a handful, isn't it?
And I feel like I'm 20. Thank you, Protandem.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
Well, you know, I've been dying to get you on, you know, and
I certainly appreciate we have to go through some hoops here and there, but that's life. And I certainly appreciate not only that you've given me the platform and the time, but your own personal effort in making all of these voices from all of these wonderful people available to people on the internet, because whether or not they listen at any given day, you're keeping a record that is so vitally important to our future. And our future we will face to the extent that we understand our past. And that consciousness of the DIY is here today. And you're one of those key elements, key people that are making it available to others. And I thank you for that.
Well, I know when I started this effort, I started it with a partner, and that partner kind of took off in another direction that had to do, it just wasn't going in the manner that we agreed in. It was going more toward, you know, being sold. And, you know, my idea was, hey, this needs to be available. I wanted the interviews to be available in perpetuity. And, you know, when I made that promise, I went, oh, my, you know, I'm trusting the creator because, you know, server space costs money. Well, you know, immediately, creator filled the need. My next person, after the conflict with my original partner, the next person that was interviewed, he said that someone had been trying to get him to to get on the radio, because this, you know, Robert Gosewolf has been an author for a very long time. He's also been heavily slandered, as has everyone that's been involved with prophecy, myself, Grandfather Rolling Thunder, Sun Bear, Wallace Black Elk, you name it. If they've been involved in talking about prophecy, they have all had mud flung at them, accused of being a sex offender.
That's
unbelievable. I mean, you know, I used to believe the stuff that was going around about Gosewolf until the same stuff started, that bizarre stuff started happening. There's still some guy out there saying I'm a sex offender, you know. It's just, you know, you just got to understand that you just can't believe. It's like Ben Franklin said, you know, well, you know, you believe half of what you see and nothing of what you read.
Correct.
And you got to go meet these people. And this friend of Robert Gosewolf said, well, hey, you know, I happen to have a server. And he said, look, you know, let's do this. You can have the space you need, unlimited bandwidth, and thanks to Griff. And I don't even know his last name yet. I understand he's also a friend of Red Elk. And thanks to Griff, you know, we're up and running. We've got the space we need. And, you know, and as far as, you know, keeping the people up and running here at the house, you know, taking a few donations, it's just keeping everybody on an even keel, and everybody's getting what they're needing, not maybe what they're wanting, but Creator's really at work here on this show.
Well, absolutely.